We're back again with the Fencer podcast. Today, we have a guest that I've been waiting to talk to for a long time. He is a huge Marvel fan. I don't know if he's as big as a Marvel fan as me, but he does feel, he does appear to be a comic book addict like myself, but he's a Marvel movie aficionado. This is Cliff Asness. I know him as just a regular guy. Some people may know him as the founder, expert of all things quant of AQR and of AQR fame. Thank you, Cliff, for joining us on the Fencer podcast today. How are you today?
I am great. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I'm alive. I'm drinking some Celsius, as much as these I should drink. And my heart and my wife who works in cardiology probably hates me for it, but it's good caffeine for you.
You know, alive is a good start, and you're a surgeon, so your assessment of alive is probably more accurate than most of ours.
Yep, we all die of something, Cliff. We all die of something. Hey, speaking of dying off, what happened to the Marvel?
Okay.
What happened to the Marvel movies, man? I've been really disappointed in what's been going on.
I don't know. You know, one thing I've read, I haven't read a ton, but I've read some, big movie people write about what makes a successful movie. And the consensus seems to be nobody knows. Like, sometimes it seems so obvious. You see a bad movie, and you're like, how'd they put this out? And several people that I actually respected while reading it or listening to a podcast have said, yeah, it sounds weird, but we don't know. We're too deep in, and what's going to be a hit and what's not is much more random to us than you realize. So I think, you know, with Endgame, it was so climactic. I have to admit it was 3+ hours and for an old man, I didn't get out of my seat to use the restroom. It was something. And then everything else feels small after that. And I just think they haven't executed. Small can be okay if they're like gritty, interesting stories, but yeah, I'm still hoping they turn it around. I never thought I'd live to see superhero movies as good as we saw. I'm older than you. I was watching in the '70s when Lou Ferrigno was playing the Hulk. And the special effects were hilariously bad and everyone looked ridiculous. And I still watch. So if you told me one day I'd be watching live action movies that would actually look like the comic books, I'd have been like, no way. That's awesome. So it was awesome. And I hope it gets awesome again.
It was great. It's funny because I remember the old Batmans where it'd be like they punch and go, it'll say like, pow. And it'd be like, and I just sat there and I looked. I remember being a kid. I used to see the old Lou Ferrigno on Hulk TV show stuff, and I thought it was awesome because we had I'm gonna date myself, but VHS tapes, you put it in stuff. And you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, you said that they just don't know, right? And that's a good transition for us because, you know, when I was 18, if you had told me I was gonna be a surgeon one day, I'd have said there's no way in hell, right? There's no way in hell I'm gonna do that. I'm not that type of person. And I think we start out life thinking we know what's going on, but the reality is when we look back, we just didn't know. Now, you've gotten to a point where you're extremely successful. There are numerous stories out there, including the one of you punching a TV or a computer screen, which I am envious of because I have several computers I would rather punch than because they don't work. But how did you know you were going to get to where you are today?
Oh, I totally didn't. The notion that there's a grand plan, I mean, maybe once every few hundred years is an Alexander the Great or a Napoleon who just goes, I'm going to rule the world or something. But the notion that people have it all laid out, particularly I was a middle-class kid, did well in, actually didn't do so well in high school, did well in the SATs, chose to go to a dual degree program because I didn't know what I wanted to study. And my dad said, why don't you study two things? It'll leave your options open. That was the extent of the plan. And I think I got very lucky along the way. I fell in it at school with some professors. I did this for money. I worked for them to program just to make ends meet. And I like what you do. How do I do what you do? And they're like, well, you know, you got to get a PhD first. I'm like, all right, I'll do that. And so things for me, you know, I don't think life is all luck by any means. A lot of hard work, ability matters, but exactly how far you get people who've gotten really far, if they don't acknowledge there was a lot of luck along the way, which I admit is not the most useful advice, you know, to look at young people and go, well, the first thing you got to do is get lucky. No, the first thing you got to do is be really good and work really hard and prepare for whatever luck comes your way. But if if we're going to look at what are in statistics called order statistics, extremes, everybody extreme has gotten lucky in some way on top of some natural gifts and some hard work.
Now, I will 100% agree with that. It's complete luck that I am here today. I mean, from the get-go, it's been me trying to screw up my own life and then life sort of pushing me in the right direction, right? And it's funny because you mentioned something that resonated completely with me, is that you saw someone who was, in your eyes, successful, and you said, hey, how do I do that? And then they gave you the feedback, well, go do this. And I kind of had the same thing. If do you think because you saw them, it gave you an idea of who you could theoretically be, or it was, hey, I'm just looking for somebody successful to guide me?
A little of both. They're overused cliches, but role models are important. Seeing someone do something that they find interesting, that you are also, in my case, studying at least the beginning levels of, seeing them do it at a high level, seeing them enjoy it, seeing them prosper, get their, in that world, it was getting their papers published and whatnot. You know, when you're young, particularly if you don't come from a background that's steeped in achievement, and no knock on my parents, but they weren't, you know, top level PhDs. If you don't come from that, you getting some model. They don't have to necessarily be close mentors. They can even be models from afar. Obviously, if they'll engage and help you out, it's even better. But yeah, we all need some model, some aspiration, some, you know, this is how you act. This is what you do. This is what the benefits are, but this is also what the obligations are. Yeah, that was incredibly helpful to me.
How do you feel like sort of your journey, right? Because you went from double major or two concentrations to being a masochist and doing a PhD, and a fellow masochist here, I went to medical school, right? How do you feel like that journey prepared you to basically enter the workforce?
Well, I am probably a little bit of a unique case here, because in some sense, I've done the same thing for 40 years.
Which is rare.
I'm amazed at people who reinvent themselves all the time. There are quite a few successful people who have a series of careers that maybe overlap a little, but are substantially different. I went to the University of Pennsylvania to go to two different schools there, the engineering school and the Wharton School. Again, this was my father really saying, you're aimless and you're good at math. So why don't you study two things that have math in it that maybe are useful? If you look at what my firm does today, saying it's math applied to finance is fairly accurate. I went straight from that dual degree program to a PhD program in finance. So I really do think I wish I were more useful, because I'm not sure you can generalize the find something you love and you're good at and do it for 40 years. But that has pretty much been my plan is actually to do it for 70 years, but I'm only 40 of the 70 through it. I may need some health advice from you, David, on how to get there. But I'm on year 40 of applying computer science and math to investment
decisions.
Well,
you look good, Cliff. I will say, so as someone who has switched fields several times, and I'm actually switching specialties, so there we go. I'm a glutton for punishment. Again, I'm a masochist. I need to, if there's any psychiatrists listening, please send me your info.
Well, I was going to ask you, any chance the new specialty is psychiatry as it applies to neurotic hedge fund managers?
No, but I know a few people.
Because we might have a trade to do, yeah, right on the wire.
I mean, so for me, it was more of, again, me getting in my own way, and then life sort of pushed me down a direction, right? So I started in chemistry, and I loved chemistry. because it was hard and everyone couldn't do it, and I could do it very well. And then it collided with basketball. And then they said, hey, you had to switch majors or you're going to not be able to play basketball. So I switched to something I thought was easy, which was applied mathematics, and I did that, right? Math. Go figure, is easy, right?
Nobody thinks that's easy, David.
So then, again, I didn't know I was smart. So then the next thing, we get there, and all these people were saying, hey, what they're going to do with their life. And they're like, hey, you know, I'm going to go be a doctor. I'm going to be a dentist. And then here I am, and I didn't know, right? And then, but I got tired of them looking at me funny. So I said, I'm going to go do what they did. And I asked, right? And then along the way, again, life sort of happens. You have these, like you said, these mentors who sort of pushed you. And every time I tried to give up on myself, there was someone there who told me to keep going, right? It's funny. It sounds like I didn't have a father figure, but your dad really, he gave you the room to grow and also nudged you in the right directions. Do you feel like that was, without that, you wouldn't get to where you are?
No, absolutely. I always credit my dad. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. My dad, no one ever believes me when I said this, was entirely anti-mathematics. My mom was a math teacher. To the extent I got it, yeah. I got it from her. My dad was a really smart man, but he was a trial attorney. He didn't think in math. He thought in words and math through him. And I'm still confused about that. But he was a wonderful role model. But more importantly, he gave me two pieces of pretty massive advice. I already told you one. He found this program, this dual degree program. I'll get into a little bit if you're interested. My rather unimpressive high school career. I'll tell you in a sec. But my dad, because I was kind of aimless, found this program. I said, because I was also aimless and didn't care, okay, Dad, I'll do that program. But then I always assumed I'd be an attorney, because I come from a family that's not entirely, but is a lot of attorneys. I should never tell this story. My compliance area will hate it. But my father's first cousin was a guy named John Gotti's attorney in the 80s, a famous mobster. For the record, Gotti was guilty. My cousin might not agree. But so that's the background I came from. Different kinds of lawyers, corporate lawyers, criminal lawyers, prosecutors in my family. I always assumed I'd be a lawyer, and you know, being mathematical, I thought maybe I'd be a patent lawyer or something. But somewhere probably around junior year of college, it was again my dad who said, and you know, common sense is so easy sometimes when you do it for other people. Common sense, when you try to do it for yourself, you bring so much baggage to it, that my dad just said, why are you signed up to take the LSATs? I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to be a lawyer like you, Dad. He's like, but you're not like me. I can't add. And this was about the time I was meeting those professors. So it all came together, and I literally withdrew. I don't know if they gave me my money back, but I didn't take the LSATs. I took the GMATs to try to get in, and got into Chicago's PhD program in finance. But our stories, they're not exactly the same, of course, but they overlap in some ways. But for me, the change from directionless to having a direction was extremely discreet. All through high school, I was the kid that teachers would call my parents in and go, he has so much potential. Why is he getting B's? And the occasional C. I haven't got a C since high school, but got a couple C's, largely in Spanish, because I refuse to memorize things. And turns out it's hard to learn a foreign language without memorizing a few things. But it wasn't until standardized tests. You know, standardized tests, some people hate them. They kind of saved my life because I, again, was at best a mediocre high school student who everyone thought, hey, that kid has potential. I shouldn't say everyone. Some people probably thought I had no potential, but a bunch of people thought I had some. And then I did really well on the PSATs and the SATs. And I said, maybe I could do something real. And then for me, I still didn't really work hard in high school. But when I got to college, I haven't told this story a lot, but I was pretty close to terrified when I got to college, because I had spent at least 4 years in high school, maybe longer, telling people who looked at me with a sad look on their face, like, oh, you should be doing so much more. I had said things like, it doesn't count yet. When I get to college, it'll count and I'll turn it up. And then I got to college and I had a huge, you know, at least freshman first semester, maybe the whole year, I had a crisis of, oh my God, I've been saying I'd turn it up when I got here for years. What if I do and I'm just not that good? Because anyone who claims they never doubted themselves is all, you know, it's right up there with, I didn't get any luck. It's just not telling the truth. And I just muscled through it. I kind of made a deal with myself. I'll give it 1 year. I'll try real hard and I'll see what happens. I think I literally turned from a type B person when it comes to achievement to a type A person in about 3 weeks of my freshman year of college. And so far, I haven't turned back. Maybe one day if I ever retire, it would be nice to try to turn back. But not while I'm still running AQR. They don't need a type B up here.
We'll be right back with the show. But first, I wanted to tell you a bit about our sponsor and the production company behind the FinServe podcast, PodPony. Are you on the lookout for a podcast producer? How about a content boost or even someone to help take your brand to the next level? Well, let's face it, creating content and keeping up with a content schedule just isn't easy. That's where PodPony comes in, your all-in-one content partner for thought leaders and business owners. From media coaching, podcast production, blogs, webinars, newsletters, website support, social media, or any other facet of the content world, they've got you covered. From initial concepts and strategies to production and distribution, the experts at PodPony are with you every step of the way. They'll help you create customized content that turns heads and brings in business. All you have to do is show up and do what you love. They'll handle the rest. So saddle up with PodPony by visiting podpony.com and start your content journey today. Now, back to the show.
Hey, I get it. And, you know, it's funny because I had a similar transition, but mine took place like at the end of the Naval Academy, right? I didn't work hard at all at the Naval Academy because I was an athlete. I was like, I'm here to play basketball. That's all I'm here for. The rest is superfluous. I don't need to pay attention. I used to sleep through class. And so the common theme, which I didn't know, which I found out later, is like, this kid has so much potential. He doesn't get it yet. And my wake up moment was I got called into the office. This was, man, 2006. I get called in summer 2006. I had just finished training. I wanted to be a Marine and go blow stuff up because I wanted to blow stuff up in the Marine Corps. And John McCain's aide was there talking to our commandant. And so I was one of the first people to find out that John McCain was running for president. His son went to school with me. So I sat down in the office. I was like, aren't you guys talking about this politics stuff? And then I went back and was sitting there and they were like, yeah, you know, we hear you want to be a Marine. I was like, yeah, I do want to blow stuff up. This is exactly what I said. It's like, it's cool to blow stuff up. And they were just like, you know, we talked to all your teachers. They all say you're the smartest one in class. I go, my grades don't say that. Right. And then they were like, is your family still struggling? Yeah. Your family still struggling? I was like, yeah. They're like, hey, you're going to go on a nuclear power program. I go, I'm going to do what? You're going to put me on where? We're going to put you on a submarine. I go, I'm not smart enough for that. There's like, yeah, we think you are. And so I went, I did the interview. I studied for the first time, hardest time I ever studied in my life. Because this time you can't fake it, right? You can't just sort of get through in a standardized test. Like, you have to actually know the stuff. So I go take it, I show up, and I get you, any person who does nuclear power in the Navy, you have to interview with an admiral. And it's funny, right? You should use this trick. So he has what's called the Rickover chair, and you can Google it. It's a wooden chair, and the front two legs, prior nuclear Navy. So it's still a tradition from there. So you have to interview with him before you can get in. And so the front two legs of the chair are shorter than the back two legs. And so, man, they have these positions. You're like scared. It's like 50 nerds. And I'm like this only athlete. It's 50 nerds in a room and everybody's waiting to interview. And people are just, you're just hearing thump, thump, because people are falling out of the chair, right? And so I was like, man, something's wrong with this chair. I heard them like, man, what the heck's wrong with this? So when I went in, I sat on the front of the chair to balance it. And the Admiral's sitting there looking at me like, this kid's not falling. And then so he looks at my grades and he goes, your grades don't reflect it, but they all said you're brilliant. I go, I don't know about that. He was like, well, tell me why you got these B's and C's. I was like, do I need to write a paper? And he was like, probably in these classes. I was like, well, I automatically start with a B then, because I'm not getting an A because I can't write papers. But the reality is I think a lot of successful people don't realize that, and they're lying to everyone else, and they say that they don't doubt themselves. I still doubt myself, right? I still go over things. And the reason why I've gotten to the point that I am is I'm so neurotic about not being bad that it pushes me to be great. And what I feel like I see from a lot of young people these days is they don't really have that same, like, not wanting to fail in front of others. And so I'll ask you is, if you are talking to an 18, 19-year-old kid who says, hey, I want to be you one day, how do I do it? What's the top three things you would tell them?
I don't know if I'm going to come up with three things. Let's leave out the obvious. Start out being pretty smart and hardworking and whatnot. Those are throwaways. What you just mentioned, fear of failure. Work a lot on the balance. This is all obvious when you go to extremes, but too much fear of failure. You and I both have that, but too much of it is paralyzing, and past a certain point is not useful. No fear of failure is an entitlement attitude where it's all just going to come to you, and that just doesn't work. Too much of the world thinks that's going to work, but that doesn't work. Another way, related but not exactly the same, I often, for anyone who plays any poker, I don't know if you play any poker.
I got it.
I played poker. I actually suck at it too, but that's just because I have no patience. I think I'm actually pretty good, adjusted for the fact that I refuse to pay attention to what
Me
the other
too.
People are
doing.
I just
play blackjack.
And I like hanging out with a bunch of other people, just chatting until 2 in the morning. It's fun. But it's not as much fun when they're all trying to take your money and you're just trying to chat. But there's this thing in poker that I'm not good at, but I understand, that's often a recommended style of play. It's called playing tight aggressive. Don't play a lot of hands, but when you play them aggressively. You know, don't nibble around the edges. And I think for a lot of people, key moments come when you have to speak up about something, when you have a non-consensus opinion. And tight aggressive has always struck me as a good model for that. Don't be so arrogant that you think every non-consensus opinion you have is earth-shaking and right and everyone else is an idiot. Even if I can be quite dismissive of conventional wisdom at times, on average, it's right. There's an evolutionary aspect to it being to it being right. But when you're really close to shore, I'll never say metaphysically certain. I'm not sure I quite believe in that. Too much of a statistician. You ever notice statisticians never say they know this?
True.
They know the probability that we're wrong is down to 1 out of 10,000, which is intellectually honest, but always has a cowardly rig to it. But being tight aggressive in this context, to me, means subject yourself to some real inquiry. Do this very rarely and occasionally, but when you're sure you're right, take a stand. For one, I think the world is a little more forgiving of if you're wrong than you realize. I think people often think if you're just dead wrong about something, it's all over, you're doomed. No, if you had a good reason and you stood up for what you believe in, look, you could be at a terrible place with someone who's just mean about it. I'm not saying everyone's perfect, but I think on average, the costs are less and you're raising the standard. You're not piping up all the time, insisting you're right. When you think you're right and you've thought about it real hard, plant your feet and say, I won't be moved. And I think, you know, it's a risky strategy. I won't pretend it's not, but I think it's a really good risk to take if you do it rarely and you do it decisively.
I agree with all of it. You know, the world is sort of changing, right? Like technology. I mean, social media didn't exist when I was a kid. Definitely didn't exist when you were a kid because you're older than me. So,
what are you talking about? I'm 32.
With that being said, I mean, I'm going to reference a quote that Jim O'Shaughnessy always tells me is, if all the data has been mined to death, right? If you're an enterprising 20 year old Cliff, does he still go into finance? Does he still become the quant today?
That's a hard one. For one thing, again, I'm old enough to remember back to those times. It wasn't clear there was that much more to do back then. I was at the University of Chicago just when something called the capital asset pricing model, which for anyone who's not into finance, this is too much in the weeds, but was kind of beginning to be overturned. But I think my impression, again, this is a little earlier than when I was there, was it was probably a 5 to 10 year period where in academic and quant finance, we didn't even call it quant finance back then, but in academic finance, the idea that markets were almost perfectly efficient, if not, you know, perfect is too extreme, but were very efficient, and that the CAPM was a really good model, was generally consensus, I think, for probably a decade. So I'm leery mm-hmm. of ever sitting here. There's a certain hubris in saying we've discovered all that there is to be discovered. If you asked me 10 years ago, what are you going to improve in your investment process? Because that's what I do as a day job. I wouldn't have been able to tell you because that's a circular question, right? I would have done it already if I could just tell you. But this maybe is if you ever do a geekier podcast and you want to get into the weeds on the finance, I think we've made some of the biggest improvements in the last that we've done the last 25 years in the last 10. But the important thing for your question is I absolutely didn't see it coming. So I don't have the strength of the opinion implied in your question, not necessarily your opinion, that there's not a lot left to do.
The strength.
I do think that strength, more of the challenge,
the strength
to successful investing long term,
the strength
is about an ornery stick-to-itiveness than it is about that next improvement, which runs a little counter to what I just said. I just said I'm more optimistic than you, and there's more to do. But I just thought of this as another observation because I do believe it. When I started my career, I would have told you the hard part is creating an investment process that on average makes money and is pretty diversifying to other things. And again, I'm not going to take it past that on this podcast. Mm-hmm. I would have looked at back tests of that. Back tests are just like you make up a rule for trading and you go look how has it worked over the last 1 to 1 billion years. Billion would be a lot. There wasn't a lot of quant trading back then. If you showed me that back test, I would have said the challenge is this real? Is it going to repeat? Are we going to make this money in the future? And mostly that has occurred. It's not been as good, but we never assumed things would be as good. If you back test a strategy, I think you're very foolish if you think in real life it will be as good as your back tests. At some point, you tried 12 things and you took the one that worked best, which means you're overestimating how good you are. But for 30 years, we've used half as good as a back test as kind of a very rough justice. Did this work out well? And it has. It's been way harder to live with than I would have realized. You go through 2-3 year periods that have been really tough. You go through 10 year periods that are good. You enjoy those, but you do not enjoy those as much as you hate the 3 year periods that are not good. I think that's just human nature. And I do think for most investors, I'm not saying it's easy to come up with a good process, but I think it is the easier part versus being able to stick to that process when it is not working. That is a challenge. It's a challenge I think we've handled particularly well and come out better for it each time. But I think that's kind of an interesting lesson that probably applies more broadly than just to my narrow example of quantitative trading. Being good at something is vital. But once you're pretty sure you're good at it, the whole world and maybe even yourself will doubt it when whatever you're doing is going through a tough period. So that's the time, I think, that determines success versus failure more than any other.
You know, you gave some great points today. One, the one that resonates with me to start with is love what you do, right? Do that to start with. Find something you love that you do it so that you're willing to stick it out through the ups and the downs. Don't always show your hand and want to be the ones that's the contrarian 100% of the time. But when you really need to be a contrarian, freaking yell it from the rooftops and stick to your guns, right? And then have conviction in what you do. Be humble about things because life will humble you. Overall, I think the students that we deal with in FinServe, and we're trying to sort of increase the representation in finance. And I'm hoping that, you know, if the model works great in the financial services, we can start to do it in medicine and law and things of that sort. Because as we sort of improve as a society, we have to sort of, just like we diversify our investments, we have to diversify the sources of information and the thoughts that we sort of contribute to each field. And I think we have that chance. And just to wrap things up, Cliff, I really appreciate you for coming on. I know you're a very, very busy man. I appreciate you and your candor and always speaking it directly how you feel. And just that is really refreshing, because some people like to, I guess, say really beat around the damn bush instead of just saying it directly. And I'm a person who I just like to be 100% with people. So, Cliff, I just want to say thank you. I thank you for your time and your team. And if you have any parting regards.
Well, no, I think you're doing the Lord's work here. It's a wonderful cause. I'm happy to contribute. Hopefully I didn't do the opposite and dissuade a whole bunch of people from finance. But what you're doing here is great. And it was also just a ton of fun to talk to you. Thank you, Dave.
Hey, thanks, Steph. Have everyone have a great day. See you later.
Bye-bye, everyone.